insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Ah, yes, the Patrick Madrid Show. Here we are, and welcome to the program. If you'd like to be part of it, just call this number. We'll get you on the air. I'll make every effort to get you on the air, 888-914-9149. Sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, and I'm here to give you the cash value. I would say that listening to the show is like pouring smiles on your brain. I mean, metaphorically, of course. So test the theory and give me a call, 888-914-9149. Want to also bring your attention to being in Holy Week now. Our special Holy Week programming continues Friday at noon Central as we broadcast the Stations of the Cross live with Bishop Robert McClory from the Shrine of Christ's Passion in St. John, Indiana. So you can participate in that by going to relevantradio.com, and you'll find all of our Holy Week offerings for you, all there. You can plan your Holy Week accordingly. Let's see. Let's get to the phones first of all. We'll start with Juan listening in Los Angeles. Good morning, Juan.
Oh, good morning. What's up? A pleasure to talk to you. It's just my second time in many years.
Yes, sir.
I used to hear you from right here, right now, and this is my second time, but I work in the morning. But my question is this. I remember as a kid that I used to hear like, oh, you're supposed to eat meat or chicken during the Triduum. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's right here in the United States only on Fridays.
Okay, so are you talking about abstaining from meat during the Lenten? Okay, so it's really simple. The formula is all Fridays during Lent, including Good Friday, and Ash Wednesday. Now, Lent technically ends the evening of Holy Thursday. But the rule to abstain from meat also applies to Good Friday.
So
those are the days to abstain from meat. Is that what you're wondering about?
Yes, because my understanding, like in some countries, it's like from Thursday to Saturday. That's what I understand. So I don't know, is it changed from country to country or just it's always been like that?
That's possible, and I don't claim to know. I mean, so if you're from, you know, the Philippines or Mexico or France or, you know, Zimbabwe, the bishops may have a different custom in place there, but certainly in the United States, it's all Fridays during Lent, including Good Friday and Ash Wednesday, to abstain from meat. Now, here's an interesting thing, Juan. The previous discipline of abstaining from meat under pain of mortal sin is still in place for all Fridays during the year, except that it's no longer under pain of mortal sin. The church decided to eliminate or remove that aspect of it. But we're still asked to abstain from meat during all Fridays throughout the year, not just during Lent. A lot of Catholics don't know that. There's also the provision that you can substitute a different penance if you wish. That didn't used to be the case when it was just a cut and dried, no meat on Friday rule. You couldn't substitute some other penance. I think most people, if they say, well, I'll substitute something else, they never really get around to it. And I'll go first and say I was guilty of that for many years. And so the easy way, if you want to approach the topic for the whole year, I would just say the best thing to do is get in the habit of no meat on Fridays throughout the year. So by the time you get to Lent, it's super easy because you're already used to that.
Oh, I got you. That's great. Also, I have another question I'm going to do real quick. Mm-hmm. The Brigittine Rosary is, how can it's not that, let's call it, very, I don't hear that. Is that valid to pray it? I think it's called it 6 decades.
Yeah, it's not valid or invalid. It's just a different form of praying the rosary. The common form that you and I know has been around for the better part of 800 years now. And it's, as you know, it's 5 mysteries of the rosary. There are other forms of that, and they're okay. You could pray them. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing one way or the other negative about it. It's good. Pray the rosary in whatever form. But the customary rosary is the 5 decades of the rosary.
Okay. If I, like, sometimes I got some spare time and I, like, try to do my own daycare, that'd be for my own benefit. That'd be nothing wrong with that.
No. How could there be anything wrong? It'd be like saying, is it wrong to tell your wife I love you too much? No, you probably can't tell her too many times that you love her. Is it wrong to smile at people? Of course not. The more you smile, the happier you feel and the nicer you are to other people. So when it comes to something like this, the rosary, devotions, prayer, what does the Bible say? The Bible says pray always. So you can be brushing your teeth and praying the rosary. You could be behind the wheel of the car, praying the rosary. You could be in the frozen food aisle in your local grocery store, praying the rosary. So anytime you wish to pray is a good thing. You're not doing it wrong.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, wonderful time to talk to you. Have a blessed day, and I keep listening to you. Thank you very much.
So nice to meet you. And you go all the way back to the right here, right now. That was about 12 years ago, almost 12 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's when I start listening. In some of the day when you used to work in Catholic Answer, interview with
Mormon, I did.
I got that tape. Yeah, well, I bought it, but I don't have it with me anymore. But
you mean you don't have it on your person at this very moment? You don't carry it with you wherever you go?
In the tape? No, I lost it. I'm sorry.
I'm just joshing. Yeah, no, I did work for Catholic Answers for 8 great years. Really loved that place. When did I start? I think it was around January of 88. And Carl Keating had established Catholic Answers years earlier, probably better part of 8 years before that. But it was a part-time venture for him. He was a lawyer by trade. And so Catholic Answers was his hobby, if you want to call it that, his avocation. And eventually he decided to close down his law practice and make Catholic Answers a full-time operation. So that would have been around the end of 1987. Beginning of 1988, and I wound up working with him at that point when the only other person besides Carl and myself was a third fellow, may he rest in peace. His name was Charlie Harvey, and he sort of worked shipping books and materials and things, and I helped Carl with writing and public speaking and whatnot. But that, in the very beginning, it was just, first of all, it was just Carl, and then it was Carl and Charlie for a week or so, and then I joined, and then I worked at Catholic Answers for 8 great years until I decided to strike off on my own. And eventually, the long and winding road led me here, talking to you, Juan. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. Okay, thank you.
You gotcha. I think Juan wants to get going. He probably wants to get going to work right now. Thank you, Juan. Let's see. Let's go to Cody in Albuquerque. Hello, Cody. Welcome.
Howdy, Patrick. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
Indeed, sir.
I'd like to know, is it a wise idea or not for a Catholic who is ready and eager to defend the faith to set foot in evangelical churches to do so, whether intentionally to have a conversation or not? And there's a reason I'm asking this, which I'll get into here in a minute. I just want to briefly hear your thoughts first.
So in the abstract, I would say if you're properly prepared and you are not susceptible to being swept away by arguments, etc., and you're not doing it as a provocateur, you're doing it to gain knowledge. Maybe you want to listen to the sermon. Maybe you want to, if there's any interaction, sharpen your skills. Then no, I wouldn't say there's anything wrong with that. But if you're going, maybe it's not you per se, Cody, but let's say it is. If you're going to cause trouble or to stir the pot or to get into an argument, then I would say no. That's not a good use of your time. And it's also impolite to go into a Protestant church where they're there to worship God and in the way that they know. If it's for that reason, I would say I wouldn't do it. But if you're going for knowledge, and if it turns into a conversation, great, and you can practice your skills a little bit, that's fine too. As a personal aside, I did that in a number of cases, both with Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and Muslims. So I got to the point where I could be much more conversant with Jehovah's Witnesses by going to the Kingdom Hall meetings on Wednesday night a couple of times. And I wore my suit and had my briefcase. I looked just like one of them, but they knew I wasn't one of them. They didn't know who I was. And they were polite, and they let me sit in the middle of the congregation, probably 150 people there on a Wednesday night, practicing their door-to-door patter. And I was there for an hour, hour and a half, whatever it was. a couple of times, and I did it not to be a provocateur, but to learn. I did the same thing many more times at a mosque near where I lived, and I went there with my Columbo routine, sort of pretending like I really didn't know much about anything. But I had many conversations with the Muslims there at the mosque, and it was a learning experience for me, so I would know better how to speak to them about Jesus. And I did toward the end of those visits. And then the same thing true with the LDS Church. Never to be a provocateur, always to learn. So I don't mean to overemphasize that, but if that's part of somebody's motivation, I think it's fine, as long as they're prepared for it. But if it's not really their motivation, then I would say don't go and stir the pot. So there's my long answer to your first question.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, like I said, there's a reason I ask. I just thought I didn't have anything to do this Saturday. Whatever I thought I was doing Saturday got canceled, and I just wanted to, you know, I'm a lover of gospel music and various things, and so I go and listen to that, and sometimes, rarely, but I always count on the Spirit to catch me off guard, because I know they're very anti-Catholic, and I don't look for opportunities.
Who's very anti-Catholic?
This church.
Okay. Is it like a fundamentalist Protestant church, evangelical church?
It's sort of like it's called Legacy Church. They don't identify with a denomination, but they would pass for Pentecostal.
Okay.
So, yeah, but I've heard.
So what happened? So you decided to stretch your legs, and next thing you know, you're in a Protestant church. What happened?
So when I was over there, one of the associate pastors who I didn't know. I used to frequent this church with one of my buddies when I was a little bit younger. So when I went in there, he was working guest services, and he said, "So why'd you leave us for a while?" I said, "Well, I now attend a Catholic church." He says, "Oh, why a Catholic church? Just curious." So I explained part of my story. I'm a convert, so I won't get into all of it, but I explained part of it. And he goes, "Okay, well," he said something about, he went into the whole thing about, so basically I said, well, it
sounds like you're listening to something in the background. Do you have a TV on or the radio on in the background?
Oh, it's an audio Bible. Let me cut that in a minute.
Yeah.
I said,
it's not only distracting you, it's distracting me. That'd be good.
Oh, no problem. I got it.
Okay.
I got it now. I said, it's long story short, I said, it's the church that Jesus established. And he goes, no, he said the church was started by Constantine, who, you know, the whole thing about.
Yeah. And I would say, no, it wasn't started by Constantine. Yeah. You know, one way you can show that that's true, Cody, is that Constantine, who was at the time the Roman emperor, had a conversion experience. He wasn't yet baptized. And he, as the emperor, he convoked the first Nicene Council. This is in the year 325. Well, all you have to do is go to Wikipedia, if you want, and take a look at the list of popes, and you'll see all the popes from Simon Peter all the way down to the year 325, when the Emperor Constantine called this council. And I think this is an important thing to pause on for a second. And so this was in the year 325, and the pope at that time was, let's see, it was either Ursinus or Siricius, one of the two. I'd have to delve a little deeper. So we know who the pope was at the time, and he was the 37th or 38th pope. It wasn't Ursinus. It was either Siricius or Damasus the First. And so there were 36 or 37 popes before the year 325. So how on earth could the Emperor Constantine have invented the Catholic Church when there had been upwards of nearly 40 popes who were called popes of the Catholic Church? How could that have possibly been the case if it was the Emperor Constantine who so-called invented the Catholic Church? It's a really basic, flimsy argument, easy to refute.
Oh, I agree. We also got on multiple subjects, including baptism. He doesn't believe baptism saves. I even pointed out 1 Peter 3:21. He didn't believe it. I just can't believe none of my tips are working.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, you have to understand. And I know that you wanted to know what I thought about going to the church. And maybe I don't want to answer the questions you're not really asking me. But I will say this. Every single one of these things is easy to answer. Apologetics 101. Catholic Answers came up on the program a little while ago. They're stocked to the rafters with tracts and articles and resources, free things that you can just use. And if he doesn't go into it, and he doesn't buy into it, or he doesn't accept it, okay, that's great. Move on. Shake the dust from your sandals and move on to the next town. You're not obligated to stand and wrangle with anybody. You can give it your best shot. But I mean, if he, you know, nope, I don't believe it. Nope, I don't believe that. Nope, I don't believe that. Then it's not really worth your time, is it? So
no.
So was there anything more to the question? Because I want to make sure I answer exactly what you're asking. We have
a break
coming.
That's it. Okay. I just want to get your thoughts and share the story with you and get your thoughts on that. So I appreciate it.
Well, I will say this in passing and in closing, Cody, if you're properly prepared and you really want to hone your skills in being a good apologist, that is a fine way to do it. I recommend the buddy system, too, so that you don't go into a situation alone, but you have somebody with you. During the break, I'm going to find out what kind of music this is because I don't recognize it. But I'll be right back. Hey, Cody, thanks for the call. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Christendom College's free principles classes. Sign up for a free online class on Holy Scripture today at NewTestamentFoundations.com. Learn to read the Bible with the mind of the church at NewTestamentFoundations.com.
Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yes, yes, yes. By the way, I misspoke unintentionally, by the way. I want to correct a little error. I was talking about popes in the early church, and it wasn't, I went back and checked myself, it wasn't Siricius. It was Pope Sylvester, who was the pope at the time of the First Council of Nicaea, convened by the Emperor Constantine. So he was the pope at that time, 33rd in line. And so I will revise my statement saying that there were 36 popes before that pope. No, indeed, there were 32 popes before that pope. Hey, I make good. I pay my bills. And I felt the need to pay that one. So I looked it up. I didn't want to go from memory, but that's what going from memory will get you. 888-914-9149. How about I'm going to go with Elida in Austin, Texas. Am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, correct.
Welcome aboard.
Hi. Good morning. I just have a quick question. Yesterday, I went to St. Jude in one of our parishes here in Texas, and I wanted to find out. I took my rosaries in that class, and I prayed, you know, because I was going to give those rosaries to my children and, you know, move them away to somebody. Do I have to bless them with a priest also, or they're blessed already with a relic?
No, they're okay, so if you, two things I want to say. It's always a good idea, it's always preferred, if possible, to have a sacramental, like a rosary, blessed by a priest. If you can, that's always ideal. But it's not required. And it doesn't in any way diminish the efficacy of praying on a rosary that has not been blessed. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if there's a relic in it, like maybe a piece of the Holy Land, some of the dirt from the Holy Land, I know some rosaries will have that in the center. That is a kind of relic. Or it may be something more, like a little piece of handkerchief or cloth that was touched the body of a saint. That's also a kind of relic. So the relic itself doesn't need to be blessed. It could be, but it doesn't need to be. And the rosary itself would not thereby be blessed in the way that it would be if a priest blessed it just because it has a relic on it. Does that make sense? Elida? Yeah, her phone's giving her trouble. Gee, I'm really sorry about that, Elida, but I think your phone is cutting in and out. Hopefully you could hear my answer. So yes, you can give rosaries to all your children. It's a wonderful thing to do. If you have an opportunity to have them blessed beforehand, that's great, but it's not required. Thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Madeline now in Virginia? Good morning, Madeline.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. So I have, might seem like a silly question, but I know that we haven't done this in our church's history in the past 2,000 years plus or whatever. Mm-hmm. But why don't we baptize babies while they're still in the womb? I ask this as a pregnant woman myself. I kind of think about this and I'm like, well, I could jump up and down. There's water in the womb, splash the baby and say the words of baptism. Like, I know there's like, I mean, granted, it's being born again. If you've never been born, I don't, you know, but like, I'm sure there's more of a reason than that. Like,
There is. So. That's a good question, though. It's a good question. So let's just start with a few preliminaries. Number one, the only valid matter for baptism is water. It's got to be true water.
Okay.
So amniotic fluid is not true water. So that would be invalid by the nature of it. The same would be true of lemonade or root beer or some other liquid that's not true water. It has to be water, number one. So the second thing is that the water must be, now you can immerse somebody, of course, that's the original form of baptism. So to be valid, it either must be an immersion into the water. In other words, somebody who's not in the water, then they go into the water, or at least underwater, or pouring. It's also known as infusion. That's the far more common form in the Catholic Church. So let's use that as an example. There is no way, if the baby is still in utero, that you could pour the water over the head. That's where baptism must take place. It must be over the head. You can't baptize somebody on the foot, for example. That would be doubtfully valid at best. But because the baby's inside, obviously you can't do any of those things. You can't introduce water, etc. But now, with the advent of modern medical science, and the ability, medically speaking, to perform surgeries, let's say, on a child who's still in utero, theoretically at least, we could say that if the womb were opened for the purposes of an operation and the baby's head could be completely exposed to the open air, that child could be baptized. You could pour water over the child. Now, that could kill an unborn baby, so I'm not saying do that because I don't know what the medical science says about
maybe
that.
Maybe with like a, could you baptize the child with like, I forget what it's called, but like a little syringe that has water in it and you just drop droplets? I don't know.
You could, but here's the thing though, the water must flow. The water must flow. That's part of the validity. It has to be true water. You have to say the words of baptism and mean it. And the water must flow.
And what would consider it to be flowing? Really technical here, because a little droplet could still technically flow just at a much smaller level.
That would be probably doubtfully valid. If there were a syringe of water, let's say, and the doctor said it's okay to squirt some water on the head of this child, that would flow. So that would work. That would be an example. But if you just put like a little thumbprint of saliva on the baby's forehead, that would not be valid because it's not water and it's not flowing.
Okay.
But that scenario probably has never happened yet, as far as I'm aware anyway. I'm just speaking theoretically. I don't see any reason I don't see any reason why it couldn't be valid if at some point in the future that were possible to do that.
So if the baby were being born, sorry to follow up with this question, but it hadn't been born yet and you're doing surgery in utero, this is all hypothetical clearly, but like if you're doing surgery in utero and the baby technically hasn't been born, would it be invalid because you can't technically be born again if you haven't been born?
Ah, yeah. So that's a very interesting question. And this gets to the heart of Nicodemus and Jesus, the conversation they were having in John 3. And Nicodemus didn't understand what Jesus meant by that. So he thought that what you're saying was what Jesus meant. In other words, how can a man who's already born once be born again? Does he have to go back into his mother's womb and come back out again? And that's not what Jesus meant. So that's really the answer to your question. Being born again, the Bible way, is the sacrament of baptism with water. It doesn't have anything to do, directly speaking, with, in other words, it's not that you couldn't be born again in the biblical baptismal sense if you hadn't already been born physically from your mother. So it's a figure of speech. When you're born from your mother, you're born, you come into this life, etc. Being born again is the Lord's way of describing the new birth, the regeneration that comes in the sacrament of baptism. So again, theoretically, even if that child had not yet been born, but if there were some way in which, through the surgery or something, that a, let's just say a priest, it doesn't have to be a priest, would be able to validly baptize that baby in utero with the head protruding, for example, not having been physically born from his mother would not have any theological bearing on that. It wouldn't make the sacrament invalid or anything like that.
Okay, thank you. So maybe this is something we could do eventually with babies who have critical illnesses and might die in the womb.
Maybe. I mean, this is obviously something for the church to adjudicate. It's not for me to adjudicate. I'm just saying that all other things being equal, if the valid form and the valid matter and the intention is there and the water is actually flowing on the head, even if in a small amount, I don't see why it couldn't and wouldn't be accepted as valid. I don't know if we're there yet in terms of the medical science, but at some point we probably will be.
Well, there's a lot of things we figured out. This is just not for you. This is just amusing. Like, why can't we have figured this out yet? Plenty of babies die before the chance of having baptism, and then we don't technically know where they go. So just, okay, I'm going on. I'm sorry.
That's
but
okay.
Yeah, it's just, I there's a lot of thought here because there's many women who are like, I had a miscarriage.
There is a resource that you'll find helpful if this is something you ponder, which is a good thing. So it has to do with, the title of it is called The Hope of Salvation for Infants Who Die Without Being Baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the International Theological Commission. It's from the Vatican. And it's a whole document just on this very question. You know, what happens to these little babies? So if you would like, we can get a link to that posted for you on the Twitter page. If you're on Twitter, it's at P Madrid Show. And we'll get it posted during this upcoming break, and you can read it for yourself.
All right. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Nice chatting, Madeline. I have a daughter's name whose name is Madeline. Always like that name. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, it happened. I corrected myself on the Pope at the time. Remember that, Cyrus? We were talking during the break, and I said—
I do remember that.
And I said, I want to correct it because it'll bug me if I don't correct it. And you said, oh, please, nobody cares. Nobody's even going to notice. I got an email from somebody. I just glanced at it a moment ago. Patrick— The Pope was Pope Sylvester. I told you.
All right. You did.
There are people who
I told you so.
You did.
They listen intently, and they are quick to let me know. So I'm glad I got there first.
Yeah, during the breaks, like, oh, I got to come back and make a correction. I was like, oh, don't worry about it. Let's just move on. No, I mean, it's a small thing. Nobody cares. And Patrick's like, no.
Trust me.
I'm going to hear about it. I have to make the correction. And all right. So I stand corrected.
It's kind of funny in a way, but I mean, I welcome any emails that come our way. But when I glanced at the email a minute ago, there it was. So it's like when, was it yesterday or Monday it was, we were talking about who was that young man in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, who when Jesus was arrested in the garden and someone grabbed at him and only got a fistful of his garment and he ran away naked into the night. Who was that young man? So I talked about, this is what the church fathers say, this is what St. Thomas Aquinas had to say, and I emphasize, you may remember this is, we don't know who he was. We're not told who he is. There are different theories, and yet 20, 25 emails came in, but Patrick, this person says it's that person. Yes, I understand. There's a variety of opinion on who that man might have been, but one thing's for sure, it really warms my heart to know how closely you listen to the program. I really appreciate that. Let's go to Michael in Barrington, Illinois. Good morning, Michael.
Hi. As you know, this week there's some great opportunities to obtain plenary indulgences, and I really believe in them. And I was wondering if you could just briefly comment in terms of the theological basis for it, and then also importantly, kind of the history of it. I've got a number of Lutheran friends, and so when I talk about my faith and the real presence in the Eucharist or sacramental confession, They almost always bring up kind of the issues in terms of the indulgences. And I was wondering if you could help me with that.
Yeah, I can. And my experience has been virtually nobody, and certainly not Lutherans, understand what indulgences really are. So it's a worthy topic for consideration. And our Lutheran friends, of course, their hero in the faith was Martin Luther, a former Catholic priest, who, with his posting of the 95 Theses, was criticizing specifically the question of indulgences. And much of it had to do with his being scandalized by the way in which one priest in particular, but there were others, who were promoting raising funds for the completion of the Dome of St. Peter's. At that time, 500 years ago, the dome on St. Peter's that we see today wasn't there. So it was under the umbrella of just giving alms in general and the church attaching an indulgence to it, but it came across in a very crass and, maybe even a self-serving way that you can pay for an indulgence, you can buy an indulgence. And that's not what the church teaches, but it's widely thought to be that. So I'll be very quick, I hope anyway. An indulgence is the church using the authority given to it by Christ. Whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. That's in Matthew 18, verse 18. The church using this authority to loose you from the need to do penance for your sins that have been forgiven in this life. So it used to be that maybe a holy card might say 300 days indulgence or 1 year indulgence or 7 years indulgence. And people routinely misunderstood that. I used to be one of them when I was a kid, for example. They used to routinely misunderstand that to think that it meant you get 7 years or 300 days or 1 year off of purgatory And that's not at all what it meant. It had to do with this is the equivalent of if you had done a year's worth of penance in this life, for the sins that have been forgiven and the penalty paid for by Jesus Christ. So the church, in her wisdom, decided to streamline this, so to speak, and make it easier for people to understand. So now the only kinds of indulgences are partial and plenary. Plenary removes all the need to do penance for sins by applying the superabundant merits of Jesus and Our Lady and all the communion of saints to this person so that if the person's disposed to receive the indulgence and has fulfilled the requirements, every bit of penance that may need to be done for the sins that have been forgiven are remitted. And the theory, I don't even know if theory is the right word here, but the expectation is that if that person were to die then and there, he would go straight to heaven because there'd be no need for being cleaned up, as Paul describes in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, before entering into heaven. So in a nutshell, that's what indulgences are. That's what they do. The church has the authority to grant this. And so you are loosed from the need to do penance for your sin. I could go on, but I'll leave it at that. Does that answer the question, Michael?
Very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is a perfect time for us to take a break. I appreciate that call, and I look forward to your call, whoever you may be. If you want to give me a call, the number is 888-914-9149. We're going to be getting into some emails as well. I also want to talk about going to church on Sunday. Whether or not you're a Catholic, do you go to church on Sunday? Do you go to church every Sunday? That's an interesting question, and there's some new statistics that are out that tell us where things are at on that question. I'll share that with you. It might be surprising to you as well, right after this. Today, we'd like to thank Rosario, who is listening in New Mexico, for donating her 2014 Fiat 500. Classy. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles, trucks, boats, and RVs by visiting relevantradio.com/car. That's relevantradio.com/car.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I have a note here that just came in. This is from Kathy. She wants to know if we can get our listeners who are fact checkers. Boy, do they fact check, that's for sure. She says, can you get them to fact check the president? I don't know. That's up to them, I guess. But let's see. Okay, mass attendance, or if you're not a Catholic, just going to church on Sunday. So here are the details that Gallup has just brought up. About one third of Americans attend a worship service weekly or almost weekly. And that number's down from 20, 22, 23 years ago. The percentage of Americans who go to church every weekend, every Sunday, or almost every Sunday, has fallen sharply, Gallup says. 30% of respondents say they attend services weekly or almost every week, down from 42%. And this is going back to a survey that was done between 2001 and 2003. So in those days, they're going to Sunday services or Mass, if you're Catholic, much more frequently. 31% said they never attend worship services in the most recent poll. Gallup says that the results add to a growing collection of data denoting a decline in the importance of practicing religion in daily American life. I don't think we have to look too far to see that, do we? In the recent poll, members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, they have the highest level of weekly worship attendance, 67%. And even that's not that great. I mean, basically a third are not going to the church on Sunday. So let's extrapolate from that. If the Mormons are the highest, what does it say about Catholics? What does it say about our fellow Catholics who identify as Catholic, but they're not going to Mass, even just on a Sunday, let alone not going every day of the week or anything like that? 30% of Protestants, 28% of Muslims, 23% of Catholics, 16% of Jews say that they attend a religious service each week. Did you hear that? 23% of Catholics, 77% of Catholics, let's flip it around, don't go to Mass every Sunday. Is it any wonder we need a Eucharistic revival in this country? If 77% of Catholics are doing whatever on Sunday, they're not putting God first. They're putting something first. Sleep, sports, I don't know, shopping. What can you do on a Sunday, Cyrus? What can you do on a Sunday morning? Because a lot of things aren't open yet, I guess. But they're putting, and Cyrus doesn't, he's scratching his head.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm flabbergasted by these numbers.
77% of Catholics are not going to Mass on Sunday. Now, this is, you know, Gallup, they do scientific polls and things to really get a sense of what's accurate. And I think this rings true. It seems pretty accurate. So if 77% of Catholics are not going to church, what are they doing? And not to put too fine a point on it, but I would say they're certainly not putting God first. Now, we're not talking here about people who are unable to get to Mass. Elderly people, people who are ill, people who have no transportation. We're not talking about that. We're talking about people who could get up and go to Mass if they just would get up and go to Mass, and they don't. Looking at a few other religions, Orthodox Christians, only 15% of Orthodox Christians, and that, by the way, is referring to Eastern Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, etc. Only 15% of them, according to the poll, are going to Divine Liturgy. 12% of Buddhists, but they don't even really have any kind of a mandate that you have to do something the way we Catholics do. The Orthodox do too. We are obligated to go to Mass on Sunday. It's called a Sunday obligation in Catholic speak. And yes, I know in the Orthodox churches, it's not called a Mass, it's called Divine Liturgy. I understand that. But for us Catholics, we have an obligation to go to Mass every Sunday. And if somebody, let's just say that you're missing Mass on Sunday for no good reason, and you mention it in the confessional, for example, and you're told, well, that's not really a sin. Find a different confessor, because we do have this Sunday obligation, and it's important. I mean, if you're not going to check in with Jesus for even an hour a week, what kind of a follower of Jesus are you if you can't be bothered? I mean, I don't mean to speak harshly, but at the same time, this is what might fall into the category of fraternal correction. For your own spiritual health and well-being, I mean, don't you think that you should brush your teeth at least like a couple times a day. Imagine going a week without brushing your teeth. Then imagine just never brushing your teeth. Except, let's say you brush your teeth at Christmas and on Easter. Do you think you would be living a healthy, socially positive life? Probably not. And that's just an analogy. Imagine the detriment to your soul if you're not checking in with Jesus, even just once a week for an hour. So what are we going to do about that? I have theories about why people don't bother to go to Mass. I think a lot of it has to do with they don't really have a connection at a heartfelt level. And I'm not judging, no heat, no judgment. I'm just saying for many people, there just is no emotional connection with God. He's a concept, perhaps. He's maybe a negative idea in their minds, like, oh God, he's that angry God who will zap me if I get out of line. And of course, that's not true. God loves you. He wants you to be happy. And he's laid out a banquet for you in the Holy Eucharist. And worshiping him in spirit and in truth can be a very uplifting thing emotionally. And if you're not in it for the emotions, and that's certainly not a high-level reason to be going to Mass, at the very least, the church says, go to Mass on Sunday. So we're going to post the link to this article. There's a lot more in it. It talks about various groups of people, and again, the differences between what this was like before and what it is now. But one thing is for sure, that this is a marker of the state of health of Catholics in this country. Even just a baseline issue like going to Mass on Sunday is declining. So we need to stop that, right? We need to reverse that for their sake, not for our sake. It doesn't do any benefit to me. And you may, if you're cynical, you may say, oh yeah, well, but the parish will get more money from parish donations and collections. Okay, I suppose that may be the case, but that's certainly not the reason for trying to encourage people to get back to Mass any more than it would be, you know, a reason to encourage people to brush their teeth two or three times a day as opposed to just on Christmas and Easter. Let's say that you happen to own a mini market and you happen to sell toothpaste. And you tell somebody, you really should brush your teeth more than just once on Easter and once on Christmas. Oh, you're just trying to sell toothpaste. That's all. You're just trying to make money. No. I have toothpaste on the shelf, but that's not the reason I'm telling you to brush your teeth more than just on Christmas and Easter.
Could this be an aftermath of COVID protocols, of when we weren't allowed to go to church?
Certainly could be. That's astute of you, Cyrus. Although I don't think that COVID is a factor, at least I don't know that it's mentioned in the article per se.
And it shouldn't be anymore. I mean, now it would be an excuse.
Right. And it is for some people. I do still encounter people who say, well, we just watch Mass on TV now. We don't go back to church anymore because of COVID. That's really deeply unfortunate.
I have family members that do that, and it is such a tough topic. How do I bring up to them that's not enough?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are different ways, of course. I think maybe the main way would be to say, so let's put it in terms of a happy marriage. So you love your wife. You want to spend time with your wife. You want to have dinner with your wife. You want to, you know, have coffee in the morning with your wife. You want to be around her because you love her. What if somebody said, yeah, but I can just see her on my phone. I can, you know, we can FaceTime on the phone from time to time. And to me, that's nice if you're on the other side of the world on a business trip and you want to see your wife and talk to her and so forth. That's the next best thing in a situation like that. But what if you could actually see her and be with her or your kids or your grandkids? And all you had to do is just get up, get dressed, get in the car, drive for 15 minutes, and you could see them. Why wouldn't you do that? You know what I'm saying, Cyrus, kind of by way of analogy?
I do. And then I can't help but think of my kids up in their room, and I'm downstairs, and I'm texting them instead of just walking up and looking at them in the face. So there's a few places here I could be better.
We are indeed slaves to our devices. No doubt about that. And so to answer your question, at least my thought, yeah, I'm pretty sure that definitely has an effect on that. It doesn't sound right. I'm pretty sure that it definitely has an effect. I'm pretty sure that COVID and people being told you can't come to Mass, the doors are locked, Oh, don't get me started. As long as we're on the topic, I'm just going to mention. Talk about, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say this because I really do believe it. Talk about the extravagant, exaggerated, unnecessary restrictions that were placed on things like going to mass. In retrospect, that was a huge mistake. Huge mistake for a couple of reasons. Number one, there were a lot of faithful Catholics who dearly wanted to go to mass. They wanted to receive Holy Communion. They were prevented from doing so. And yes, I know. I remember what it was like. Nobody really knew what was going on. And we were getting mixed messages from the so-called experts. And we were being told one thing and then another. And come on, don't buy masks. Those don't work. And then later it was, oh, you got to wear a mask. And all this stuff. So I understand it was a time of
You do not know what you are talking about.
Oh, you're the most guilty person of all. You.
No, you misconstrued that.
No, I did not. You were on record. You were on TV making the rounds telling people you don't need to wear a mask. Masks are not going to help you. This kind of mask that you can buy is not going to help you, blah, blah, blah. And then you change your tune. You're
absolutely
the most guilty
not.
Of all. You are the most guilty.
Absolutely not.
You do not know what you're talking about.
It varies from candidate to candidate.
I don't miss him at all.
No, me neither. Get out of here.
Yeah. Shoo. Scat. But I will say this. This is where I was heading with all that preamble. Looking back on it, that was a pastoral mistake. To tell people, you can't come to Mass. You can't come into the church. You're not allowed to, you know what I'm saying? So without going through all of that stuff again, it left an indelible dent in the Catholic identity of more than a few Catholics who drew the erroneous conclusion, erroneous but understandable, I guess, under the circumstances, I guess. Well, if it really doesn't matter if I go to Mass, if it's really not that big of a deal, and after all, for 6, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever it was, the churches were locked anyway, and they said, go to Mass, quote unquote, by watching it on TV. We all did that. How come I can't keep doing that? So they reason their way to an incorrect conclusion, but it's based upon past experience. And I don't fault people if they're not really plugged in or they don't really have a sense of emotional connection with God. I don't fault them for drawing a faulty conclusion. I would just like to see that corrected. But all the exaggerated stuff, like handing out communion with tongs, just in the moment, let's just say it was the fog of war and people were confused and they were trying to do the best they can. But in retrospect, with hindsight being 2020, there was a lot more exaggeration than there needed to be. Precautions, yes.
We'll keep the local systems in line.
Precaution. I'm not blaming bishops and priests of trying to use fear. I'm certainly not saying that. Some in the government, sure. But what I am saying is this is, and we have to take a break in a moment. What I am saying is this, is that we're looking at the Gallup poll and it's showing a precipitous drop in mass attendance. And as to your question, Cyrus, could this be partly the result of COVID? I think it probably could. Now, I scanned the article and it doesn't mention COVID as a factor, but I'll bet a little deeper digging could turn that up. So let's thank God and rejoice that the churches are open and you can go to Mass and you don't have to stand 30 feet away from the next person and you don't have to wear a mask and you can receive Holy Communion. Let's make the most of it while we can, right? Hopefully that'll be forever. I'll be right back. Now!